There's a whole lot of things I want to tell you about. Adventures dangerous and queer. Some you could guess, and some I've only hinted at. So please lend me your ear.
Everyone has a relationship with gender. What's your story? Hello and welcome to Gender Stories with your host, Dr. Alexian Taffy.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Gender Stories. I am so excited to be in London interviewing Dave Pickering. Dave is not only amazing because he's facing the heat in London to come and be a complete stranger of Twitter to be interviewed, but he's also a podcaster and storyteller. Dave has two podcasts, Get It Better Acquainted, which won the British Podcast Award last year, I think, right? 2017. And also the Family Tree podcast, and hosts for Spark London. And I think Spark also has their own podcast.
That's right.
Dave also has an upcoming book called Mansplaining Masculinity. And so obviously I could not resist interviewing him. And he's also been really amazing at kind of lifting my podcast, which is really new on Twitter. And Dave has been on BBC Radio 4. So needless to say, I'm slightly intimidating to be interviewing somebody who actually knows what they're doing. But here we are. So thank you, Dave.
Thanks for having me on your show. I'm happy to be here, really. Yeah.
So on the way here, because we were trying to find a place in central London to
record. Which is hard.
It's really hard. So you might hear some background noise in this episode. We were talking about kind of storytelling and gender and what storytelling got to do with gender. And yeah, why don't we start from there?
I mean, it's a really interesting question. I mean, like with any question, like the problem is that you then have to define the words you're using. So what is storytelling? Like, we're quite comfortable with the idea that humans are one of the things that is a general common theme within humans is that we are storytelling creatures. But how we tell those stories are wildly diverse as human beings are. I found myself in this kind of genre, I guess, of true storytelling, which is a very specific kind of storytelling. How that relates to gender, I'm not fully sure. I mean, I think it's a really radical thing to do, whatever your gender, to stand up on stage and tell your truth to a room full of people who can't interrupt, right? So they just have to listen, and you're sharing your lived experiences. And what makes it, I always think what makes a great story is that the more specific it is, because the more you are specific about your life experience, the more universal, weirdly, the story becomes. Because that's what gets us to those things like fear or sadness or happiness or joy that we can all relate to. But like, because the specificness is how that person experiences whatever that joy or whatever it is, it just becomes more real the more specific they are, and true in inverted commas, because that's the problem. True is another word that we have to define. But in terms of gender, I think it's, for me, it's been very powerful as a man, a cis man within society, to be talking about my feelings, talking about mental health issues, talking about masculinity and things like that, in that forum, in a discursive, emotion-filled, like non-logical, non-rational space. And so I think that's an interesting thing that true storytelling can give that. I mean, it's interesting. I host a monthly true storytelling night, and initially I did find sometimes I would have to say, to encourage people to sign up to tell stories, I would have to say, well, lots of men have come and signed up straight away, but other genders have not, and like, I would like us to have a good gender weighting on this stage. But that happens less and less now, actually.
I
think that's an interesting thing, actually, because in a way, as much as there are still kind of confident men who are signing up, talking and telling stories is actually quite gendered feminine in culture, in society, like gossip, talking about your personal lives, all of that stuff is very gendered, not for men. And so I think that that's an interesting factor that comes with true storytelling. Although, of course, because it's performance, there's also this kind of hyper-masculine performance culture of, like, bare your soul, I suffer as an artist, and I'm sharing that. So there is a kind of tradition of men talking about themselves, very much so. So all of these things I think about when you say gender and storytelling, I don't know if at this point I've got any general trends I could say about it. But it is interesting. Like, it's like, I guess it's a little bit like how the best paid chefs in the world are men, but women do the majority of the cooking. And I think you could probably say something quite similar about true storytelling, who gets rewarded, who doesn't get rewarded, who tells the stories, and who don't. I mean, it's like there's some theories at the moment that suggest that Homer might have been a woman. And, you know, keeping the stories within culture, fairy stories, things like that, have traditionally been very much woman-centred. But at the same time, the people who've been paid for writing stories, paid for performing stories throughout history, have generally been men. So,
yeah, that creates some quite interesting tensions, like you said, right? Because the storytelling aspects kind of being seen as more feminine, even oral history, because you're involved in some oral history projects,
right?
And often we think of oral history as something that gets passed on by women more than by men. And yet a lot of historians are actually men. So there is this tension between kind of who gets paid for what, how much is performative, right? So if it's performative, men want to do it. And also how much, I'm interested in the fact that initially you said a lot of men came forward to sign up. And I wonder how much of that is kind of being used to being okay with putting your story forward.
Yeah, exactly.
Centering yourself.
My story is important.
Yes.
The main thing I try to teach people when I do true storytelling workshops is that their story is valid and important and as interesting as anyone else. I mean, when I have guests on Getting Better Acquainted, which is a conversation format, a similar thing happens. I'll record with them and at the end I'll say, oh, I'm sure that wasn't very interesting. Other people's are really interesting, but mine's not interesting. And the same thing happens in true storytelling. Everyone as a rule is more inclined to think their own story is less valid and interesting than others, but men are more likely to think they're valid, I think, because society has told them that that they're valid, and they are valid. That is, you know, I don't want to throw out I don't want to say the baby with the bathwater is such a tired term, and I don't really know what it means, and it sounds quite horrible, whatever it does mean, but I don't want to lose that there is a value in believing that your story has validity, and lots of men don't feel that as well. Like, we only hear from the loud ones, we only hear from the confident ones, and I'm also aware that there's lots of men and boys particularly out there who don't feel that they're valid, who don't feel that their experiences are valid, whatever, for whatever reasons, some of which will be tied up with gender and some of which will be tied up with lots of other systems of oppression that surround us all. Yeah,
lots of other aspects of their identity. And that's interesting also because it's not just men, but like which men come forward, right? And like you said, it's this paradox that's like, it's not that men's stories are not valid because they are.
Right.
Like, it reminded me of like that quote, Stanley and Weiss, or like feminists from the 70s and 80s, talking about the personal is political,
right.
And if the personal is political, then it's everybody's personal.
Right.
Even like, you know, they didn't use the word cis at the time, but they referred to like cis, straight, white, heterosexual men.
Right.
Also have stories. And the stories that are interesting sometimes are those stories that are not, in narrative terms, sometimes they're called like thin stories. They haven't been thickened in society.
Right.
So a lot of the stories of masculinity are very much about toxic masculinity.
Right.
Often, rather than like, maybe stories that are counter to that. Do you find that that's coming up both in your storytelling events or when you're having conversation with people, that those stories are maybe not as dominant around masculinity, harder to...
I think that it's interesting.
Yeah.
True storytelling is actually a format that rewards people for being honest and open and talking about their flaws. Like, you're not rewarded if you don't understand your flaws. So you might tell us, if someone tells a story that is very judgmental about other people, that person will be judged. But if they tell a story that's kind of open about their own biases, that person will be celebrated, even if their story is presenting what they did in a more negative light. Like, you can tell a story about being a terrible person, but as long as you're aware that you're a terrible person, people will understand and relate, and we're all terrible people as well as we're all lovely people. I mean, there's all of these things around us. So it's interesting. I actually think that at true storytelling events, men are rewarded for being quite opposite of toxically masculine. Like, and men who'd come and are toxic in their masculinity are the ones who don't do as well, that the audiences don't enjoy, that don't connect. And that's one of the things I love as a cis white straight-ish middle class man. I've got all of the kind of boxes of like privilege mostly, but I can sit in an audience and hear somebody who has, you know, very different boxes that they tick, and we will relate. Our two stories will relate, and I will do a story about my mental health, and, you know, a woman of colour will come up to me at the end and say that really chimed with my personal experience. And I think that's a powerful thing. And what I love about true storytelling is that it is through diversity, through specificness, through recognising how different we are, that we can actually see that we're similar. Whereas I think when we focus on how we're all universally similar, that's when we actually erase loads of people's life experiences, including my own. And like I say, on paper, that shouldn't be the case. But one of the things I was thinking when you were talking then was, one of the things I observed within popular culture, within kind of representation, is that as much as people like me are overly represented in pop culture, I'm not going to make the claim that we're not, only some versions of people like me are. And what I want to see is more uncertain men, more men who are like, who cry, who don't know the answers, who like are like, oh, what was it recently? There was a show I saw where I felt really, I can't remember what it is actually, because I want to, so I can't remember it. But there was a particular show where I was like, I have not seen me represented, and there I was in the lack of security, in the lack of like understanding of who I was, all of these things. Like, men are either shown as certain, whether they're heroes or villains, or they're shown as ridiculous because they're comic characters. Yeah. When men are uncertain, that's hilarious.
Yeah, and they might even be rewarded for their incompetence.
Right.
It's really exciting.
I've actually remembered where I felt represented and seen. It wasn't actually a TV show. Rarely for me. It was a book recently. The first book of the new Philip Pullman trilogy, the La Belle Sauvage, which is the first book of the Book of Dust. The hero in that, Malcolm Polstead, he is a young boy who is interested in ideas and really caring. And his heroism comes from caring. He actually is looking after a baby for most of that book. His heroic moments come from him expressing love. And that's something I don't see men as being put into that category very much. And so that's why it was powerful for me.
And we need to see those representation if we are going to raise like an old generation of boys.
Right.
That, you know, if we're going to dismantle the patriarchy, we need to make sure that like, boys and men do have representation of alternative way of being.
Right. There's the patriarchy right there trying to cover this idea up. They don't want you to know.
I feel the timing was really impactful of that noise. Yeah, the patriarchy can go on for quite a long time, apparently.
It can. Oh my God, it's gone on for far too long, hasn't it?
Right. When is it gonna end?
When will it end?
So, you know, if we can't see ourselves, it's hard to imagine another way of being.
Right.
I know that's definitely true for me as a trans non-binary person.
Right.
The more I can see representations, the more I'm like, oh, my gender is possible, and it opens up more possibilities. Like my friend Magdalen Barker always says, what does this open up and what does this close down?
Right.
So it sounds like this story like really opened up for you, like, oh, yes, there is this way of being, and it's my way of being.
Right.
And I realized that it is not one of those like dominant narratives. It's been
right.
A very kind of quiet narrative that lots of men have been just quietly living in the background, but not have seen really.
Yeah, and it's through those narratives that I think, from the point of view of cis men, those narratives can liberate cis men, mm-hmm. I think, or help liberate. It's rare that the stories on their own do the work, but they are part of the work of liberating ourselves. But it also helps us to kind of, if we're going to have solidarity between different groups, to understanding our own personal experiences and the systems around us that cause those experiences are a big part of being able to have solidarity with other groups. So my own, I don't know, I'm not one of these people who says, oh, I'm so glad I was bullied at school because it's taught me stuff. I'm not. I would have much preferred not to have been bullied. But having been bullied at school in quite a systematic and kind of othering way taught me, it doesn't mean I understand what it's like to experience racism or transphobia or any of those things, but it does mean that I have had the experience of being othered, and it does mean that I can see how the reasons that I experienced that were the same pressures that were affecting other people. They were just exhibited differently on me because I was a cis boy, mm-hmm. and so the pressures around me that were trying to make me conform or be different or hate myself or, you know, whatever, were the same things that were hurting, you know, gay people, women, trans people. They're exactly the same things. And having had that experience did open my eyes in a way that I think a lot of cis men haven't had their eyes open. But at the same time, I'm also very aware that many cis men do.
Yeah.
But they don't always interpret it in the same way. So there's loads and loads of cis men out there who've been bullied, who've been abused, all sorts of things that have happened to me, but they don't see the enemy as being the systems.
Yeah.
They see it as feminism or women or whatever, that their pain ends up with them hurting other people in much worse ways often than they've even been hurt.
Absolutely.
So it's a really complex thing, but I really hope that we can see more narratives of men, whether they are the ones who end up hurting or the ones who are mostly hurt. Those aren't being represented, and I think if men can't see them, then we can only aspire to toxically masculine hero tropes that are off, even when they're at their best, are often not that great. Like even male heroes, when you really boil them down, they're only heroes in that story. They wouldn't be heroes in everyday life, you know.
They have to do like exceptional wild things,
right?
And that's interesting. Like when you were talking about that, I was thinking about. I think it's Audre Lorde that has a poem where she talks about basically our roots of oppression are the same, right? And that's exactly what you're talking about, that until we can see that we might be impacted differently, but like cisgenderism hurts everybody.
Right.
Cellacolonialism hurts everybody.
Right.
Racism hurts everybody. I saw a really powerful tweet today, I can't remember where it was from, unfortunately, but it basically talked about how if white people listen to those stories of racism but do not mourn, then it becomes like trauma porn, I think it was the thing that was used, right? We like revel in other people's trauma and their stories of hurt, but we don't understand how like we're deeply connected as human, right? It's that paradox of the specificity helps us connect to the collective that you were saying earlier.
I mean, also that's the thing, when you're treated as a default, whatever that default is, you don't interrogate your own circumstances. So as a cis person, I never had to question what gender meant. And I wish I had. Maybe I wouldn't be cis. Yeah. Maybe I won't be cis in the future because I'm already interrogating these things.
Yeah.
But like, and similarly, like it's assumed people are straight. It's assumed people are cis, and so nobody gets the option, the opportunity to explore their sexuality or their gender identity. And similarly, like white people don't think about white culture. White people don't think about white heritage. Like, I am somebody who's, you know, my granddad was born in India and had people carry him around, you know, literally people carried him around as a baby, right?
And what does that mean?
Right, yes, and what does that mean for my family? What does that kind of making yourself into somebody that sees humans as not human, what does that do to your humanity?
Absolutely.
And how does that pass down? Like we think about inherited trauma, mm-hmm. and often we're talking about marginalized groups inherited trauma, and I believe that's true. But there is also probably, I think, an inherited trauma of the oppressors, and we pass that down, and then people remember the empire as a positive thing, and we have Brexit, rather than remembering the empire as what it was, which was systematic domestic genocide and horrible things, and trying to work out how do we change that now. And I mean, that's very pertinent to me because my niece, her dad is Jamaican, and so I always think, like, with her, she's got these two heritages inside her. She's got the people being carried and the people, you know, working in the plantation. Both of those things are within her identity.
And they're within our body, right?
Right.
We have this complex identities within our body. And even whiteness is such a weird thing. Like, when I lived in the UK, I was an ethnic minority as an Italian immigrant, right? And I had, like, British people say things to me like, isn't it great that you have culture? Because we don't. Like, literally, several people said that to me. And I said, well, let me tell you about British culture, because I see it all around me. And I would tell them about British culture, and they're like, oh, that's just how we do things. And I said, that's what culture is, people. And part of the trauma of whiteness, right, is that it erases that specificity of our ethnicity, and especially for, I think, kind of Anglo folks, placing themselves as the norm. There is this huge loss of belonging and self, and that then kind of perpetuates the systems of oppression.
It's actually part of why some people have, you know, overtly racist attitudes.
Yep.
Part of that often is about being jealous of the seeming coherency of the communities that they see in front of them, and then they look at their communities and they think, we don't have that coherence. Well, part of that is you're seeing a lie, like you're only seeing it through your own lens, and so you're putting your own assumptions on there. But there is a truth within that, that in some parts of white culture we're losing our ability to kind of think of the collective. You know, and that's partly because whiteness is mixed with capitalism, which is mixed with individualism, which is kind of all over the world to all of us.
Which is then mixed with toxic masculinity. I mean, there's a reason why movements like UKIP, you know, the UK Independent Party, or white supremacy attracts so many men,
right?
I remember, like, you know, being really scared I would get, like, my head kicked in when I lived in in a more kind of rural area in England, especially. I was afraid to go out on St. George's Day because lots of UKIP folks would be out and for skinheads, right?
Yeah.
And now it's, like, completely different in the US when there's been assimilation and I'm seen fully as a white person. But I was thinking about how many of those folks are young boys and young men who have really no, you know, the unmet need underneath all the shittiness of what they're doing, which is really scary. Their unmet need is, like, a sense of belonging, a sense of pride, a sense of community, a sense of family. And that's really sad when I think about it that way. And even the few folks who talked about, and it's usually men, kind of leaving kind of white supremacist movement, what it gave them is a sense of pride, belonging, connection, family.
Because men are socialized in this way that means that we are, like, more fragile. We're actually not designed to be to embrace change, fluidity, all of these things, which is not to say that women aren't also socialized with some of those things. Like, there are certainly cis women who are white supremacists.
Yes, cis white women
in fact,
are problems.
Yeah,
we know that.
And there, you know, there are men's rights activists who are women who I've met. You know, it's a very strange thing as a man to be having to explain, or, like, at least say to a woman that patriarchy isn't a good thing for women, in front of a room. In fact, I was asked that question in front of a room of students, so I had to I had to give a good answer because it wasn't just her I was talking to. And that's a strange thing. It's a strange, these strange contradictions. Actually, one of the things I've discovered doing a show and doing work around patriarchy and masculinity is how I can't just assume that a woman agrees with me. Like, I have made that mistake too many times. Like, not, I don't expect women to agree with me on the fine details of my thoughts, but I have an unfortunate predisposition to assuming when women are at least believe that patriarchy exists, let alone, like, probably even are a feminist. And those, I've been disabused of those assumptions quite a few times of late, and now I don't assume those at all when I meet people.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is really, it's a sad reality, as especially now with the Gender Recognition Act in the UK, there's a lot of, like, arguments between trans exclusion and radical feminists. And I think it was Kristen Burns, just in the last couple of days, did a really great tweet about how this is just serving the patriarchy. Like, men are having a field trip right now.
Definitely.
Like, you know, kind of male supremacists, let's call them, for want of a better word, you know, kind of seeing, kind of basically, like, having an inner fight within our feminist movement, which is completely unnecessary because the roots of our oppression are in that kind of white cisgenderist heteronormal.
I mean, it's in gender essentialism, really, as well. Like that's part of the problem. That I say it in my show, and I'm sure it's appropriate in this conversation too.
Absolutely.
As much as you try to not enforce that gender binary that we've all been taught since birth unnecessarily. And, you know, I say we, I mean people within the culture that I grew up in.
Yeah.
It certainly isn't a universal thing to be born into the idea of gender essentialism. But because we're taught it so deeply, it takes so long to unpick it that it's very hard to, like, use language within culture and not in some ways enforce binary. I mean, like binary genders. I mean, particularly in languages which have gender, like, built into them.
Oh, my first language, Italian, is totally like that.
Right.
And McDonough, Barker and I have just come out of a writing retreat. Writing, life isn't binary, and how that doesn't apply just to genders, but, like, sexualities and thinking.
I think there's so much.
Yeah.
It's like realizing that gender wasn't a binary was like the spark in my head to realizing that I've not really come across a binary that's true.
Yeah.
Like, I keep waiting for one. I mean, obviously, there's the mathematical 1-0.
But I'm sure that's, I don't know maths.
Right? I would have maybe said that, you know, biological gender was binary like 10 years ago, right? But now I know all about the science of it. I know that, like, that's like when people come up to me and say, scientifically, you're wrong. You know, sex is actually binary. I'm like, what the hell? Like, now I know chromosomes, it's not just XX, it's not just XY, and all of that stuff, which I know you already know, right? I mean, but like, that, and that's the thing. Like, so I was, you know, suspicious that the maths would also turn out to be as complicated when you know about it, when you're not just talking about the headlines.
Yeah, I'm not a mathematician, but the rest of my family is really greatly into math, and I understand that that might not be as binary as people think either.
Right.
And talking about binaries, you know, we do have this kind of gender male-female binary, and you do have a book that's going to come out, right?
Yeah.
Mansplaining Masculinity. So
this
seems like a good segue in talking about, like, how do you see, you've already talked about your role as kind of like a currently a cis man, kind of taking on this dismantling of the patriarchy through storytelling. That's how I think about you, taking on the dismantling of patriarchy through storytelling.
Yeah.
So how is the book part of that for you?
Well, I mean, so basically, you know, in 2015, I decided I was going to make a show about masculinity that was going to have a true storytelling element to it, a kind of TED Talk element to it, I guess, and a kind of, I'd been before that for about 5 to 10 years, I'd discovered the internet in a different way than the way it was when I was growing up, and I'd realized that, like, I could listen to so many people who are not like me and learn and just, like, absorb all of this amazing work that's being done by all of these people. And so I'd had, like, 5 years of, like, really picking up, like, internet memes, internet theories, and so that was a big part of it too. I wanted to kind of weave those in with true storytelling, because as much as I'm very much aware of these people and these ideas, that's not the case when the people I meet in everyday life. The internet is a series of kind of silos that we're all in, and it can be a mistake, again, to assume that everybody's up to date with all of the memes, and they're not. I know, because I've done this show now, and people they don't always know them, and I have to often explain them. But anyway, so I had this idea of wanting to put all of that stuff together, and I started researching it. First of all, I read a book called The Will to Change Men, Masculinity and Love by bell hooks, which transformed my whole sense
it's
of
so
the
good.
World
it's
I love
so
it
good.
I recommend it to any cis man out there, but everybody I think benefits from it, and, you know, and it talked about lots of things I hadn't really thought about, like the way that women reinforce patriarchy, you know, the way that mothers give that to their children, which is something that was, I guess, done to me, but not something I'd consciously thought about. So that sort of made me, like, blew my mind. But then I had this other problem that I felt like I probably had to define what masculinity was, but I didn't really feel like I could do that. Like, it feels like something that defines me rather than something that I have any idea what it actually is. I'm not sure if it even exists. I don't even know if like I say in my show, like, what is a man? Like, what does the word man mean? I'm not sure whether men and women really exist. But at the same time, we obviously do practically exist within culture. It's a bit like race, yeah. Social construct, but we still have to work with what we've got in this moment. So I didn't feel like I could define it. And also I feel like I'm not a very manly man. Like, that's partly what the show's about. So I felt like it was a bit of a swizz for me to be defining masculinity when masculinity never wanted me in it.
Wow, I really want to pause on that. Masculinity never wanted you in it.
Well, not at school, like, right?
Masculinity as an agency of its own through culture, right?
It got to the point where it felt like that, I think, maybe when I was younger, definitely. Like, there was, and there's a lot of shame, I guess, that you have as someone who's been harmed a lot by cis male culture when you also exhibit those behaviours as well, because you're brought up within that culture. So there was all of these complications within it. Like, I'm not trying to say I'm outside of masculinity. I've certainly been a man in the worst ways as well as in the best ways. Like, I'm a human that's been assigned male at birth and throughout culture have been kind of put in that position. So I've done my fair share of harming people. But at the same time, it never felt like a club I could get into. Certainly, as I sort of alluded to earlier on at school, it was a club I was forcibly shoved out of, consistently told I wasn't. Now I'm in a sort of similar position again. Like, for a lot of years I had short hair. Now I've got really long hair. I wear purple and I've got purple glasses. And those are things that suddenly mean I'm not in the club of men again. Like, I walk down the street and now I'm seen in othered ways of various different kind of from various different origins. Maybe I'll be, maybe someone will shout Jesus at me in a really aggressive way, which is super weird. Yeah. Like, why are you shouting a person of peace and love at me as if it's a criticism? Like, if I do look like Jesus, what's wrong with that? I mean, I'm the wrong ethnicity for Jesus, so I don't.
I'm glad we made that clear.
Right.
But the dominant culture.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, but whether it be Jesus, whether it be kind of transphobia because people think I'm trans, or because particularly or misogyny because people are seeing me from behind, whatever it is, I'm now in the position of getting street harassment again, and I haven't had that since I was a kid being bullied at school. So it's interesting to, in my 30s, be reacquainted with what it is to be slightly othered. I mean, I say slightly because I know that I know that some people are listening going, someone's saying Jesus at him and he's complaining about it, whereas I can't leave my house without being beaten up. And I get it, I get it. I'm not, like, saying I'm not privileged too. But anyway, I wanted to know what masculinity was, so I wanted to ask men, so I set up a kind of a survey about being a man, and I managed to get 1,000 anonymous men to fill it in through various kind of social media pushes. So I have a kind of database. It's an open source resource that's available on the website of 1,000 anonymous men's thoughts on gender. Some of those men are trans men. I didn't do enough demographics, so I can say that some of them are trans men and some of them are men of color, but I couldn't say how many. Only when their testimony tells me that. I wish if I did anything differently, I would have done that differently. I deliberately didn't want it to be a rational, scientific, objective survey. So it was set up as a provocation designed to provoke stories and experiences and responses. But I still think that the demographics would have been useful, and I wish I'd put it in. I should also say it was actually 1,002 people who filled it in, because two women insisted on filling it in. Wow. They insisted on taking up space. I understand some arguments for that. I also was worried at the time that it was going to become a trend rather than a couple of protests. And it is interesting to see how those two women objected to the idea of a space for men, when I don't object to women-only spaces. So that was an interesting moment, again, to be confronted with. But anyway, I made that piece of research. I've used it in this show mostly just as a frame. It's mostly the questions that I've used, and I answer those questions myself within the show, because I can't do it justice. An hour is not time to, like, manage to give all of these sometimes beautiful, sometimes depressing.
It's
really, men have said a lot of different things. Some of them are they're fighting against patriarchy. Some aren't. For a while, it was mostly liberal-minded kind of... I used inverted commas around liberal, by the way, listeners. But liberally-minded men, I would say, or feminist-leaning men, initially were the people who filled it in. But somewhere within the middle, men's rights activists got wind of it, so quite a few neo-Nazis have also filled it in. So it's got the range of masculinity, and I was actually glad of that, even though, obviously, I don't condone the thoughts and experiences or beliefs of neo-Nazis.
So you got an insight.
I got some insight, yeah.
Exactly, or some insight, yeah. And I love, like, I have two questions that are fighting in my head. One is, like, I would love to know some of the questions you asked in the survey, but I'm also really intrigued by this idea that you were talking about, kind of where the book was born and the research,
yeah.
That it's really almost having this paradox in your body, where this is this body that you've been brought up assigned male at birth, and also this is like the cultural construct of masculinity that hurts you, and so it's and both
right.
of them are within
it's in
the
me.
Same body, it's in you.
It's in like that's it. Well, we talk a lot. Well, people who talk about theories around politics talk a lot about internalized misogyny or internalized. Transphobia or internalized racism or whatever, and I think that that's very much the space that a lot of men, cis men, are inhabiting, is a place where we've internalized a lot of hate around men, around ourselves, around what men do, and we've also internalized a load of things that make us quite hateful, actually, sometimes. So we have these two kind of, we've got misogyny in us, but we've also got what I'm going to call misandry, but I want to make clear I'm not a men's rights activist, and I do not mean it in the same way that those men do. I mean, when I talk about misandry, I'm talking about hatred of men, and that isn't most. I see that mostly as being exhibited by people like the men's rights movement, like people who say men can't help themselves, they will rape people because they're like intrinsically rapists. That's hatred of men.
Absolutely.
And men's rights activists say that because they say, oh, that's what men are like. You can't expect us not to be that way. That's hatred of men.
Yeah, how little do you think of
yourself? Exactly.
That's how you think of yourself, right?
Yeah. Do you think
terrible.
You've got no agency?
Yes.
Do you think you are powerless? That's an interesting statement to make, isn't it, when people make those kind of statements. This idea that we have a lot within culture that men are kind of powerless, mm-hmm. that we can't, like, for example, we're always consenting, like because we can't not like sex. And I've been raped by a woman, and I know that that's not true.
Oh, I know a lot of like male abusers, sexual
right,
abuse
exactly,
survivors
yes.
in my work, and that's one of the that toxic masculinity is like the air we breathe,
right?
And really often, what happens is that feeling like like there's an assumption of consent,
right.
And I can't push back,
right.
Because that would be aggressive masculinity, and that's almost like it's its own experience and its own paradox
yeah.
in the body that's actually really challenging.
Well, women are taught like just persevere and you'll convince them in a way that we never would these days suggest to men.
No.
Like you wouldn't say, oh no, just persevere. I mean, yes, we would have done in the past.
Yeah.
That was terrible, mm-hmm. And we should. And I'm not saying there aren't men who do that. They are.
Absolutely.
There are. They're terrible too. But I mean, you know, within rape law in this country, that's an interesting one. Like only mm-hmm. people with penises can commit rape. So like only
yeah.
men or people that society has decided are men are can legally commit rape in this country, and that's not true. The idea that only penetration is rape
no.
is absurd to me. Like rape is about losing the agency of your body and
yeah.
somebody using that body against your will, and it doesn't have to be heteronormative
no.
In its way that it is enacted. So like all of these things, you know, that I learned through doing this show and by asking these questions. But in terms of the questions, the first question I asked was, does patriarchy exist? Which
wow.
really annoys people. Particularly, like, a lot of men copy and pasted, like, well, actually, that comes a bit later. But the first question is does patriarchy exist? And that, yeah, like, people are like, why are you asking that before you defined it? People get really angry about that. And I, you know, because I wanted to be provocative.
Yeah.
But then the second question is, you know, how would you define patriarchy? And there, you know, men will copy and paste dictionary definitions. Like, they don't want to, like, define it for themselves. You know, there's a lot of men who believe that patriarchy exists, but only over there, in other countries, not in our country.
That's right, we're finding it.
Right.
Was it just English?
It was, I think, because it was online, it could have been global, but I think it slants towards the UK experience, and probably a bit of kind of American experience too. But yeah, like, it's people over there. And also there's this sense of, like, patriarchy used to exist, but now it doesn't. There's a lot of that.
Oh, right. We're a post-feminist society or something. Yeah.
And then if people do think that patriarchy exists, some of them don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, which is something I kind of hasten to point out when I talk about the show, because only 15% of the responders didn't think that patriarchy exists.
Wow.
But then I think it's quite, like I say, a skewed sample, because they started off my friends and people who knew me, so they all agree that patriarchy exists. I'm not surprised. But, like, there was diversity within it, like, and some people, you know, really hate patriarchy, some people, you know, see some good in it. Like, there's lots of different complicated, diverse opinions about what patriarchy, how it functions, what it is. And then the next questions were, how has patriarchy hurt you, and how have you hurt people as a result of patriarchy? Which I think
those
both
are intense questions.
And some of the answers are very intense. But I do think you have to ask both those things to men. You can't just say, how are you hurt by this culture, without asking men to take accountability for how they've hurt people. But you also can't just ask them how they hurt people without looking at, like, how they've been hurt.
Absolutely.
Like, both of those things are really key to seeing how patriarchy perpetuates itself. Because another way that, when we wanted to talk about hatred of men, you can look at why men end up in the army, why men end up in industrialized jobs that put their lives and bodies in danger, why they end up in prisons. All of that is kind of on one level, because we think men are irredeemable. Once they become violent, they are. That's in our nature, you know.
Well, and boys are subject to actually far more violence than we talk about.
Right.
I mean,
super loads more.
Not to diminish, like, the misogynistic violence that girls and women are subjected to, especially girls and women of color. But boys, and boys of color as well, are subject to incredible amounts of violence from an incredibly young age, including systemic violence such as violence and even killing at the hands of police.
Exactly.
So it's just it's so early, that contact.
Right. I mean, because that's one of the things that I try and say in my show, like, that not all men, this kind of meme that we're kind of, many of us are familiar with, whilst it is problematic in the way that it's used, because it's always derailing actual useful conversations, and is unnecessary to point out all the time, because very rarely are people suggesting all men when this phrase is used. It's also important to understand from an intersectional point of view that all men are not the same, that we are wildly diverse, that there are disabled men, men of color, trans men, and all of these men will, like, experience masculinity and the pressures around that in very different ways. And, like, when we talk about hatred, when I talk about hatred of men, one of the groups of people I think suffer the most from hatred of men is trans people, because they're penalized for being too male or too female, right? Like, when we're talking about that particular culture within the UK of certain kinds of trans-exclusionary feminism, and I don't think that we should call them radical feminists, because they're rarely radical feminists. They're generally liberal or media feminists in my reading of it, but fine. The people that we refer to as TERFs, quite often, those people hate men and take it out on women generally.
Yes.
Like, absolutely. And it's and the men that they do take it out will be the most marginalized men as well.
Yeah.
So,
which is also fascinating, thinking though about who centers which story, because, like, with the hashtag not all men, it is often cis white straight men that use it.
Who are saying that.
And we're saying
that. And they're the default. They're the ones who are considered all men, ironically.
Exactly. And they're the ones who are doing the behavior that they're kind of challenging, whereas, like, the most marginalized masculine folks are not the ones who are getting in there going, hey, it's not me, kind of thing.
Well, the way I describe it in my show is, if a teacher said to you, be quiet, it's too noisy in here, like, would you put your hand up and say, I'm not talking? Or would you, like, ask the people next to you to like keep it down, let's all, and create a community. And that's what I see that men should do, really, is like, if we think not all men, let's prove it, let's demonstrate it in our actions, which are much stronger than our words. Like, let's show that not all men, if you really care, if you really think people think all men, and there are people who think all men, my mum is kind of one of those people, which is one of the places that this show has come from, but those people are very rare. Like, hardly anyone thinks all anyone. Like, most of us, even people who think they think all X group, often in practice don't. Like overt racists often will have a couple of people of colour that they won't consider to be racialised for their own selfish needs of wanting to be interacting with that person in a different way than they do with other people that they want to discriminate against.
Oh, yeah, so, we don't think about you when we think about those people.
Right.
You know, I even have people say terrible things about immigrants, and then I'm like, hey, like, right in front of you. And they're like, well, we don't think about you that way. And I was like, but I am.
Right.
Like, you're talking about me, but you are making it separate in your mind to make yourself feel better. Because, like you said, nothing is ever that binary. Like, but what I love is that you're taking those concepts and kind of turning them on their head a bit. Like, I love the name of your book, Mansplaining Masculinity.
Right.
Because mansplaining, it's its own phenomenon.
Right.
Right. So where... I mean, is that how you see what you do? Because that seems...
I
like
mean, somebody said, I did. So I did my show, and, you know, the other day, and one of the students put their hand up and said, you know, why is it called mansplaining masculinity? Because, as you said in the show, mansplaining is a patronising thing, and I didn't feel patronised by your show. And I thought that was an amazing compliment. I'm glad that my show didn't patronise that student. But I also, you know, the reason I call it mansplaining masculinity is, again, part provocation. It draws people to it from quite a few different perspectives. A lot of people are really ready to be angry with my show and hopefully come away not angry. Other people come to my show angry and leave angry in a different way, probably, because they assume I'm going to sort of say one kind of thing and I say a different thing. But it is, I am explaining, and I am a man explaining, but I am not, like, the show itself is addressed to men. It's designed to be me explaining to men rather than all other genders. Although all genders are welcome, and actually I think all genders get something out of it. And actually a lot of women, cis women, have come up to me afterwards and said, you know, your show has made me rethink my sexual history, things like that, which is great to hear. I'm glad, because I don't think it's just men that need to look back at our sexual history and think about consent and we've done and re kind of... Because I think we're in a great moment, where we're redefining what consent means. Like, words change over time, and I think that's great. Like, I think lean into it. Let's change it more. Let's change it for the better. But I think as we're changing, as we're making those changes, we have to work out how to change without alienating the people that were born into generations which were socialized differently. Like, it's finding that way to grow together, which is so, like, un-male coded, right? You're not supposed to grow, you're supposed to do. You're supposed
That's
to
true.
Have something integral inside you that you push through, and because of your innateness you can push through it. Well, as I like the idea of changing our mind, like, I'm not the same person I was a year ago, or 10 years ago. Like, I make a podcast, so I have to sometimes listen back to me in 2011 to think, oh, should I re-air this, because I don't have anything to put out this week. And then I'm like, no, I can't re-air this, or I have to re-air this with me talking about it beforehand, or I have to edit it because I don't agree with me then. Like, I thought gender was binary. I thought that men were the problem in a different way. I thought that, like, back then I would have thought that, you know, the world would be better off if all men were wiped out, right?
Right. And that's not a form of self-hatred, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely self-hatred.
And there are, like, dystopian kind of novels around that. What happens when you go to that other extreme, which is often what happens with trauma, right? We go from one extreme to the other.
Right.
And then hopefully, eventually, the healing process is a place where we can expand and contract kind of more naturally and organically, and not go from one extreme to the other. Because the erasure of cis men is not the answer to the dismantling of the patriarchy. And what I love about your work is that you do this beautiful work of, like, talking to men, kind of staying in your lane, so to speak, and at the same time, though, kind of really lifting up people of all genders and voices of people of color. Like, and you do that even on social media. I've seen you do that quite a bit on Twitter.
I mean, we'll see how people feel about the lane I stay in when the book's done. I mean, the book is with Unbound, so they're half publishing company and half crowdfunding company, so it won't happen unless people pre-order it, unless people buy it in advance. And in, like with all crowdfunding, there's other levels, rewards you can get or not. I mean, if you pay £50, you get to be a cookie champion, which means that you get the cookie of looking good about what you're doing. I'll literally give you a cookie, but that's all you'll get. That's the one I hope that lots of men will be tempted to pay into. But there's other options that are more actual rewards than that. So it'll only get made if it gets funded. But the first part of it will be an extension of the show. So a much longer, all the stuff I cut out, all of the rest of the stuff I wish I'd said to men. The second part will be what I learned through doing the show, and that will be addressed to all genders. Because it does turn out, after really thinking about gender for a lot of years, I now feel like I can maybe move my lane over to be in the more dangerous perspective of trying to talk to everybody about how we all kind of are part of this horrible jigsaw. That's what I say in the show. It's a horrible jigsaw puzzle that we've made, where everyone's hurting everybody else, and everybody's pushing different. Like it's like, you know, women. Much more often in my life have I been told to man up by a cis woman than I have by a cis man. Like, so we're all mixing it up, right? We're all doing our damage in different ways. Half the time, really casually. Like, when I was bullied at school, when people would call me the nickname they called me, like, people would half the time say that really casually. Like, that's just something I do for 5 seconds in a day. Like, and that thing, that's how we most oppression is. Like, a lot of people would, like, you know, you can destroy someone's whole day in 5 seconds just by saying something. And then if you walk off and you're not thinking about it, you're still in your head a perfectly good person who hasn't done any harm to anybody, you know. So it's super complicated.
Complicated, and you might have totally crashed somebody for like the rest of their life with that kind of careless remark, especially the more power you have, right? So if you're a teacher or a parent
So it's about power. It's like my mum saying to me when I was, you know, 13 years old that men were irredeemable and were the problem and all of that sort of stuff was stuff I really internalized for years. But her saying that came from very negative experience that she'd experienced from cis men. And you know, cis men who, you know, I'd also experienced bad things from some of them. I mean, not all men. My dad's fine, but my stepdad is much more of a problem in terms of both me and my mum's experience of patriarchy. Although my stepdad's the one who can say sorry and look at his own actions and regret them in a way that my mum can't. So.
Because nothing is simple.
Yeah, it's super complicated.
Exactly, and it's like that, that is a really challenging remark that came from her pain, but also shaped you in some way as a teenager, because then what is the possibility of being if you can be nothing but that?
Right, because I did ask, you know, what about the men, or at least what about me? Yeah. Like, she said, men are terrible. And I said, what about me? And she said, yeah, you. Like it's inherent. It's impossible to escape.
And that's a powerful statement to make as a parent to your kid. Mm. And it came from this place of pain.
Yeah.
And
I mean, I don't really hate her for it. I don't, I understand where it came from. And you know, that's what happens in a patriarchal system. Like, if you, you know, ultimately, as much as we can get frustrated with the individuals who have abused or oppressed us at different times or whatever, like, it is the system. It's a systematic change that can give us any kind of recourse, like any kind of better future comes from system change, which is not to say individuals shouldn't be held accountable. Again, it's always this balancing act,
right?
Of, like, making sure that that more than one thing can exist at the same time. You know, we can fight for like the damage that happens to men in society without obscuring the damage that happens to women. Those things don't have to be in competition at all.
No, and then the damage that happens to all genders.
Right, exactly. Right? There you go. That's an example of how, like, as much as I, you know, can be as as much as I want to be dismantling the gender binary, I am just slip into it. It's very hard not to slip into it.
Right?
And
yeah.
That is not to say that it is not on me to learn to not slip, because I want my non-binary friends to not have to listen to me saying that again.
Yeah.
Like, I want to say all people and not say men and women. So let's work towards that, everybody.
I love it. I could talk with you for days.
Right.
At this point, like, we could go on and on, and I'm aware that I was like, oh my God, we've talked so much longer than usually my podcast says. So
Well, I'm a man, you see. I talk. Men take up space. That's the problem.
Well, I don't know if it's my masculine side that also
right,
likes
right,
to talk,
right.
Or my Italian side.
Right.
Knows,
right.
So
that's
complicated.
Right.
I could talk with you all day, but I'm aware that we probably need to wrap up. Is there anything that I have not asked you about that you were like, I really hope we would talk about that?
Well, I think there's two things I'll say to round it up. The first is that the third part of the book will be the survey results and analysis of that. So there'll be three parts to the book. So I guess that's the end of me explaining what that thing that I want everybody who's listening to buy in advance, to pre-order, to help make happen, particularly cis men, because I prefer your money to be what funds it. But at the same time, I welcome all money to fund that project.
And maybe cis men should buy like two copies.
Right.
One for them and one for a library, or one for them.
Absolutely.
And one for people of other genders.
Well, there is an option to buy one for yourself and five to go to libraries. So would be a good option for those cis men to go for. And the other thing I thought, which came up when we were talking, I think might be an interesting thing to at least add in, is when you were talking about embodied, like how our experiences are embodied in our bodies. That's an interesting one, I think, as well, from the point of view of cis men, because I think that cis men are, generally speaking, socialized not to have much of a relationship to our own bodies.
Absolutely.
And that is something that I would love to have better, like a better relationship with my body, with like to not think of just someone in my mind. And when cis men are embodied, they're often exploited for that body. That's where their manual labor comes in. And
yes.
Things like that. But then even when they're doing manual labor, they're not doing it in an embodied way, and that's why they get so many, you know, damage from doing it, because it's about what's best for capital and not what's best for those bodies that are performing that labor.
Absolutely, which is that intersection again, like working class men of color,
right.
Are kind of
fat men as well,
fat
yeah.
Men in specific ways, like they're really like, yes, unhealthy and...
Right. And yeah. So I think, like, one of the things I think that men can learn from sort of the culture that cis women are in kind of incubated within is to, like, be more in touch with our bodies, to be more aware of it, just as cis women probably want release from that focus, constant
yes.
hyper-focus on bodies.
Yeah.
Like, it's like this midpoint that would be great for everybody of all genders to be able to get, where we're, you know, within our own bodies, but at the same time not objectifying ourselves through the kind of lens of culture
so
around
us. We could
us.
Be subjects, and we could be whole beings.
Right.
All embodied beings. Wouldn't that be amazing?
Amazing.
I
sign me up
that.
For it. I'm there.
Me too. I was like, that's a dream.
I mean,
right?
It sounds really easy, doesn't it? Like, you know, 20 weeks of therapy didn't give it me, you know. So, like, it takes a long time, right?
20 years of therapy as a client, and also now over a decade of being a therapist.
Right.
And I'm still not quite there. So
right.
There you go.
There's always further to go, but, like, as long as we're walking in the right direction, I think.
Right. Oh, my God. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is amazing. Can you please tell the listeners again the title of your book, but also if they're interested in your other podcasts, in your website, like where can people find you on the internet and
right.
And anywhere else.
So the book is Mansplaining Masculinity, and you can find that. It's on the Unbound website, which is unbound.com/books/mansplaining-masculinity. Nice and snappy, that URL. If you want a snappier URL, davepickeringstoryteller.co.uk is where you can find everything I do, which is a lot more than just... I'm not just defined by my work on masculinity, although these days it feels like I'm increasingly more and more within that box. And you can find Mansplaining Masculinity, the show, as an audio free audio podcast, the research stuff, and loads of other information. The Radio 4 piece I did about masculinity at mansplainingmasculinity.co.uk, and I'm on Twitter at goosefat101, and I'm always up for making new connections, hearing from different people. So look me up and reach out. But yeah, Google is your friend. Anything you can't find from those URLs, you can find just by Googling it. It will be there.
And I'll put your website also on the description of the show. Thank you so much, Dave. This is amazing. And listeners, especially cis men, you need to buy Dave's book. And then if you're interested in gender, people of all genders can also buy the book that MacDon and I have written, How to Understand Your Gender, A Practical Guide for Exploring Who You Are, which is the so not snappy title of our book. We wanted to call it Gender Guide for Everybody, but the publishers had other ideas. So here we go. And we're getting noisy again, so that's probably our clue to go for today. So thank you so much for listening. And until next time, I hope you enjoy keep dismantling the patriarchy.